Windows or doors sticking? Cracks in your drywall or brickwork? These can be signs of a structural foundation problem. PermaSeal can help with that. Free inspections, transferable warranties, financing, and peace of mind. PermaSeal, 800-421-7325 or permaseal.net.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, our opportunity to take a look at the world of theater and the arts each weekend. Now, this time, we're kind of merging the world of theater and art, if you will, because we are focusing in on a new book which concentrates on an old building in the city of Chicago. That building is the Uptown Theater, which is, to me, is just one of the gems of this city, if the city could figure out, or anybody could figure out a way to get it back up and running to its glorious grandeur back when it first premiered in the city back in 1925. The book is called The Uptown, Chicago's Endangered Movie Palace, and that's exactly what it is. And one of the co-authors of the book joins us, and that's Robert Larzell, a journalist, a photographer, and most importantly, a U of I grad. So, Robert, good to see you. Congratulations on the book. You have a co-author named James Pierce. How did you split the writing versus the photography here?
Well, the photography is mostly archival photography. So even though I take pictures and I have some snapshots I took inside the Uptown Theater, the book itself, we have the historic photos from when it opened in 1925 and some other pictures from over the years. And then we basically went to a number of photographers who have gone into the Uptown Theater in recent years and taken pictures that document what it looks like today. It's been closed since 1981. So, yeah. You know, it's 100 years. The building's 100 years old, but almost half of that lifetime, 44 years, it's been in limbo, closed to the public.
And I have been in that building, and it is, I mean, when I was there, and it was probably 15 years ago, but it was in disrepair and leaking and whatever, but I was given a tour just to see this architectural treasure that needs to be restored. We'll talk about that. That's the interesting thing, because the book, which is a beautiful coffee table book, I have to say, it's, if you love, I read every page of the book, but for people who go, I don't like to read. You don't have to. Just look at the pictures, because it's gorgeous pictures.
But I want you to read.
Well, I know you want us to read.
Yeah, but to answer your question about my co-author, and he goes by the name Andy, even though his byline is James A. Pierce. Okay. He wrote the introduction to the book, and he's been involved in a long time with the Friends of the Uptown, so he's been a volunteer there. He helped me out a lot with the history, which I was the main writer for, gathering information that he had collected over the years, and we both had some role in gathering these photos for the book.
Yeah. And indeed, the book, unlike most books, if you're going to buy a book, I did a recent show on the Fine Arts Building, you sort of read about this building and you say, oh, that was just lovely. Yeah. This is a book with a purpose, because you're not, you just don't want us to know about the history of the building, which you do, but and all that has gone on, which we'll talk about. But basically, the end of the book is a call for help.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and actually it was our publishers, City Files Press, which is a Chicago company, and it's run by Rich Kahan and Michael Williams. And they were the ones who really kind of pushed us to make the book have this mission. I'm a journalist, so I'm used to writing things kind of, you know, I take both sides. I'm fair and objective. I don't always kind of like make the case for something to happen. But in this case, we all agreed that really the Uptown Theater, first of all, it has to be preserved. It's a city landmark, so the city has decided this building should not be torn down. But, you know, it just seems like a shame for it to be sitting there, and then people can't even go in and see the inside of the building to see what it looks like. It hasn't been used for concerts or anything.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit and then go backwards, because in 2011, you write about the fact that Rahm Emanuel actually took on to this project. And it looked like in 2015 and that period of time, that's probably around when I went into the building. Yeah. It looked like this thing was going to happen. So what happened?
You know, honestly, I think Rahm Emanuel, when he made the announcement in 2018 that this project was about to happen, I think it was premature, because they optimistically thought they were going to get all the financing. And, you know, they still had a final chunk of money that the owner of the building, Jerry Michelson, needed someone else to step forward with X amount of money. It was about $30 million at that time, and never really worked out those details. And then the COVID pandemic hit, which Jerry blames that for kind of scrapping the whole thing, or at least putting it on hold. And now the project, the cost estimates have gone way up. So he's saying it's going to cost way more
It
than
gets even more
kind of
restrictive. So the building opens on August 17th and 18th, I guess a dual day thing,
Yeah,
back
those
in
two days.
1925, as you said, closed in 81. It was opened as a movie theater. Now, today we think of a movie theater, oh, I'm going to the local thing. There's 120 seats in there, whatever it is. And if I'm lucky, they'll bring me a sandwich to my table. This had 40, has 4,300 seats. This is on the scale of the auditorium theater, which is about 4,000 seats. The grandeur, as you look at the pictures of, say, the Nederlander, formerly the Oriental Theater, or the Cadillac Palace Theater. I mean, this is one of those grand buildings that's been around for 100 years. So, number one, first of all, give us the landmark status. And number two, please assure me that there's no risk of it getting Medina templed, meaning we're going to take all the grandeur and it's going to be, well, we're going to get rid of the grandeur, we're going to turn it into a furniture store.
Well, I mean, I can't say for sure that there's no risk of that. I mean, the building was landmarked in the 1990s as a city landmark. City council decided this building shouldn't be torn down. And, if the city sticks with that and follows the law, that limits how much they can, revamp, what repurpose it. I mean, that you can repurpose it, but you can't just tear out the inside and ruin all this historic decor. Jerry Michelson likes to tell a story about how when he was buying the building, one of the guys who owned it at the time wanted to put a go-kart track inside, which is like, oh my God, I
I
can't.
guess anything. Well, that's kind of my Medina Temple thing. It used to be this beautiful thing. And then I went in one day and it's Bloomingdale's. And with all due respect to Bloomingdale's, it's like, but back to the building. So it exists. People can walk, you can go see it. It's there. 4816 North Broadway, right up on Broadway. So that ordinary, I think, triggers for some people. So it's basically your uptown with this, hence the Uptown Theater. Lots going on up there. But 1925, why isn't this downtown where you have some of these other classic
Yeah,
buildings?
so Balaban and Katz was the theater company which started on the west side of Chicago and became one of the biggest companies in that business. And they had this philosophy or this approach of opening theaters out in outlying parts of the city. And they could see that there were places like Uptown that were springing up that were almost like mini downtowns outside of the loop. Up until then, if almost all the movie theaters and stage shows and things like that were in downtown in the loop. But this was part of a new movement to open theaters. People could go live in the uptown neighborhood or nearby and do all their shopping there. They didn't need to go downtown for it, so why not go see movies there too?
And I think the next year, 1926, we get the Aragon Ballroom. So there was a tension. Rap and Rap were the architects of this particular building. And maybe they're not as well known as, Louis Sullivan or Sullivan and Adler and stuff, but very well-known architects of structures. So there was an effort to bring this part of the city, which is sort of Lawrence, Broadway, up there. It's still there. And all that Green Mill area is up there, right? I mean, so this area was sort of developing at that time.
And you also have to consider, I mean, you were talking about how people think of a movie theater being smaller. And so it's just inconceivable that you would build a movie theater with 4,300 seats in it. Like, when are you ever going to get an audience of that many people? But at that time, it was still silent movies, but people were buying movie tickets multiple times more often than they do today. And this was not just one show per day. You had multiple shows. So one of the fascinating things about this building is that you have these huge, ornate lobbies. You could have 4,000 people sitting in the auditorium watching a movie, and there might be 3 or 4,000 people who are waiting to get in. So they are standing around in the lobbies, and then when the crowd leaves at the end of the movie, they would all go out onto the side streets, Lawrence and Magnolia, while the crowd for the next movie is coming in on Broadway. So they really had this kind of pedestrian traffic flow really well designed so that you could get thousands of people in and out of the building, very quickly.
That's why the pictures are so magnificent, because it is just, I mean, that's why I mentioned auditorium, these other buildings. Think of these grand structures.
Yeah.
And that's what this was. And that's what it needs to, I think, return to again. But also, I used to be an usher. That was my first job growing up as a teenager, movie theater usher. Back then, we had to wear like sport coats and ties. But that being said, the staffing of this theater, an usher, that's just a piece of it. There's footmen there. I mean, this was like running like a hotel.
Well, and they still have these machines there. I don't know if they could get them to work, but these boxes with lights on them.
But where the seats were available, that thing?
That would show like an usher showing people to their seats in one part of the theater would say like, oh, this aisle is full now. So he would hit a button and then it shows up as a red light. So when the people at the front of the theater are directing the next group to where they can sit, now they can look at the lights on this.
Yeah, I was surprised when you write about that in the book that like, oh, that technology was kind of, I mean, I guess it was there. We had the light bulb and stuff, but we didn't even have that when I was an usher, I'll tell you that. But yeah, these, they could look and see, no, that section's been filled and moved on. By the way, you write about the very first one, because I think people watching are like, what was the first movie? And back in 1925, it was Madame Saint-Jean, if I'm saying that right, with Gloria Swanson. It was a silent movie. So that leads me to ask, you. That means there's an orchestra there. There was a Wurlitzer organ, because that's the way silent movies were played. That organ is now at San Jose's California Theater. Well, how come we don't have it?
Well, you know, as time went on, this theater never got split up into smaller, you know, a multiplex kind of thing. It stayed a movie theater for many decades. But as time went on, no one was playing organ at movies anymore. So, you know, it sat for a long time unused. And then in the early 1960s, some people bought it. It got kind of, you know, there's stories about how the pipes from the organ were sitting on someone's porch in Downers Grove or Cicero. They kind of tried to reassemble it at the Hoosier Theater in Indiana, but that never happened. And then the theater, the California Theater in San Jose, bought the console, which is the, you know, the part of the organ where the organist sits down and plays the keyboards. But the pipes themselves seem to have scattered to the winds.
It's just amazing. Robert, there's so much more to tell. I want to tell people about this. It's not just the movie theater. What it's seen over the years has been amazing, from rock concerts to the Marx Brothers. I want to talk more about that with you, along with where things may go. Can you hang with me a little bit? Because I got to go to a commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to actually talk about the Louvre in Paris. But if you can hang with me, I'd appreciate it, because we're talking about Pick Up a Copy, the Uptown, this magnificent coffee table book, Chicago's Endangered Movie Palace. My guest is Robert Lorzel. Thank you for being with me for this. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back after these words. Hey, welcome back to Paul Listed Behind the Curtain, our bonus conversation with Robert Lorzel, who is the author of the beautiful coffee table book, The Uptown, about the Uptown Theater. It's endangered. He and others are trying to save it for years. I've been there. I've been inside. It needs some help and millions of dollars, but we want you to know more about this treasure in the city of Chicago. It is still and always has been located at 4816 North Broadway. So, then the question becomes, I think, Robert, is when does it fall on hard times? It's around in 1925, opened in 1925. You're not far from the Depression, but that didn't close it.
No, and you get to the 1940s, and, you know, like I've looked at the box office statistics nationwide, and like 1948, I think, was sort of the peak when people were buying per capita like 32 movie tickets a year, which compares to 2 tickets today, you know, like way more. But then within just a couple years, you know, TV comes along, there's other changes in the movie business, and basically the movie industry tanks within a couple years. And so it became a struggle in the 50s and 60s to maintain audiences. They brought in a wide screen, they started doing pay-per-view boxing matches and things like that. But by the late 1960s, the place is looking a little rundown when the Tribune reporter visits. I think one thing is, I mean, with a building of this size, it's just costly to pay people to dust everything. And to, you know, just think of the cleaning staff, of like making sure everything looks nice and is in running order. I mean, it's not a simple thing, and it becomes expensive. So the owners of the theater at that
time, by the way, I just have to toss it. the lobby itself had three grand chandeliers.
Yes, yes. There were a lot of paintings and sculptures and fancy furniture that got auctioned off in 1969 and 70 because, you know, the owners at that point kind of thought, like, why do we need all this fancy stuff in this theater? Let's make some money and just auction it off.
So an economic decision, it certainly wasn't a visionary decision.
No. And then in the 70s, mid-70s, like 1975, it starts hosting rock concerts along with the movies. And that really kind of, you know, creates a new heyday for the theater where, you know, a new generation of people are coming in to see the Grateful Dead or Bruce Springsteen or Bob Marley performing there.
Or and Prince and Rod Stewart. And yeah. By the way, one of the things you write about is that I guess sometimes the management or whoever, they'd look the other way. Like you, I mean, if people violating like smoking or different kind of rules, they kind of said, ah, this is Grateful Dead. It's just going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I talked to a guy who was in charge of security who said that, you know, they're supposed to enforce the fire code and the fire marshal is saying you can't have people standing in the aisles, but the Grateful Dead fans want to dance by the stage. And they talked to the cops and the local police commander basically said, yeah, fine, just keep an eye on things. And so they had a more loose attitude of like, okay, let the people dance near the stage if they want to.
Yeah. Let me take you back before we get into this modern era, but I want to go back a little bit to that original era because we know the name of the first silent movie, but then talkies come in. So I actually began to wonder, and before I read it in your book, I just kind of went to Google and said, what was the first talkie at the Uptown Theater? I thought the answer would be the Jazz Singer because that is the first, it wasn't completely talkie, but Al Jolson, and there is speaking in there. Apparently, there's not certainty that movie ever did play the Uptown Theater, but you offer some certainty of what might have been the first semi.
Yeah, so when the Jazz Singer opened in late 1927. Yeah, it was at the Garrick Theater. It was a big sensation. Everyone was just amazed to see synchronized sound coming out of a movie screen, and you can see the person singing. The Uptown Theater and a lot of other theaters weren't wired for sound. So, you know, like even if they got the Jazz Singer, they didn't have a speaker system to play the sound. So they had to get all that going. And so it was not until that following September. So it's like almost a year later. And the first one that they had with synchronized sound, but no dialogue, was a baseball movie called Warming Up. And then a few weeks later, they had a movie starring Myrna Loy, State Street Sadie, which did have some dialogue in it. And I think at that point, there's still the movie business is still trying to get up to speed with the sound thing. So you see these movies during this transition where they only have like a couple scenes with dialogue. It's almost like a silent movie with a bonus scene that has sound in it.
Because that's the way it started. I mean, that's what, you know, even like I say, the Jazz Singer, there were moments you'd be hearing the silent movie part and then all of a sudden, boom, Al Jolson is, I think it was just when he would sing a song or something that it turned into that. But because that field was just beginning and just starting. It looked like, by the way, you just triggered something in my head. You said the Garrick Theater played the Jazz Singer downtown. This is maybe an unfair question. It wouldn't be in the book. But were there any rules at the time like, well, if the Garrick Theater had it, well, then the Uptown Theater wouldn't be allowed to have it? Was there any territorial in
contract? There was a lot of territorial stuff going on. And in fact, when around the time the Uptown Theater opened, Balaban and Katz was really a big business in terms of running movie theaters, but they were struggling a little bit because they didn't have the connections in Hollywood to ensure that they got the best movies. And it was just a few months after that they made this big deal, basically kind of merging with Paramount Pictures. And one of the Balabans ended up years later becoming the chairman of Paramount. So Paramount and Balaban and Katz kind of became this entity. And then they were accused of hogging all the best movies. So, you know, this is what happened. This all went to the Supreme Court in the late 40s in the Paramount case.
Yeah.
Independent theaters were saying, you know, Paramount and Balaban Katz are hogging all the good movies. And if I open an independent theater and I just want to show some movies, I'm really struggling to get the films that people want to see. So that became a big issue.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, that's why I say this book is so great, because you really tap into all of this. Also, back in the movie time, and I don't know if this was tied, maybe it was tied to sort of we need to try and find ways to make money, because in 1928, so now we're just 3 years into the opening of the theater, we start seeing live acts like the Marx Brothers. And by the way, it was four of them. It was Zeppo who joined them. And you sort of even write about that each one would have their moment on the stage. But talk about the introduction of The live acts, was it about the money or?
Yeah, I mean, actually, that was from the very beginning. So Balaban and Katz had this idea of presenting movies as part of a package of entertainment that would include the orchestra plays some music outside of the soundtrack. You know, the organist, Jesse Crawford, was the big organist star. So he would play a song. Some act like the Marx Brothers would do comedy routines on stage. You would see a newsreel. You would see a Felix the Cat cartoon. And then you would see the feature film. And actually, one thing I found interesting, if you look at the newspaper ads for the movie theaters back then, they didn't list show times. So you didn't know when the movie started until you showed up at the theater.
Well, you said there
And you
were
would
two
walk
exceptions. You
in. Yeah.
said you knew there was the 1:30 tea time show. There was that, and there was, and then at a certain time, 2:30 or something, is when the cheap prices went away. That's what you knew.
So you would show up, and if there was an open seat, you would walk in, and maybe you're in the middle of the overture. Or maybe the movie's just starting, and then you can stick around and continue sitting there and miss and see the first half of the show that you missed when you walked in, which is kind of a crazy concept. But I think older moviegoers will remember, that kind of thing. But this thing went away, all this live entertainment really kind of hit the skids when the Depression came along, and it was just too expensive to do it. And after that, after about 1933 or so, there are occasional moments when the Uptown brings in live entertainment, but it really becomes more of just a movie theater.
Yeah, and then we hit sort of the late 40s, and now we start getting, and I started having the Chicago theater come into my head in terms of competition or whatever you might want to call it. Because, of course, in the Chicago theater, when you start getting to that period, you've got Lucy and Desi on stage, you've got Jerry Lewis and Martin on stage. And here at the Uptown, you had Ella Fitzgerald and Mel Torme and Henny Youngman. So are they
That
now
was one
flirting?
triple bill with those three people playing,
Oh, okay, so there they are together.
which
So,
I
but it,
like. It sounds
It seems to me
astounding.
that at that point, Balaban and Katz are they kind of going, okay, the movie thing isn't working. I mean, oh, we need to compete with Chicago. What was happening at that point
Well,
that's
that
shifting?
particular thing in 1949, at the end of 49, they did as an experiment, like let's bring back these live shows. And somehow, it's kind of a mystery to me. Why did the Ella Fitzgerald, Mel Torme, Henny Youngman show, did it flop? Or what happened? Like after that played for a week, suddenly the company announces, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. I think it was, I would guess perhaps it was just the costs.
Okay. Also, I could see Mel and Ella doing a lot of stuff together with Henny, kind of like say your jokes and get out. Take your wife, please, and you're gone, Henny. You then have a chapter towards the end of the book called In Limbo. And that's when I think you sort of introduce us to the point where we're saying, okay, you've read the history of this theater, you've enjoyed it, we got you up to speed, and now, well, and now what?
Well, yeah, and this starts the final rock concert was the Jay Giles Band in December 1981. And at that point, the people who were running the theater at that point were showing Spanish language films. They were having trouble just with upkeep for the building, and so they couldn't afford to heat it. The bathrooms were in bad shape. So they shut it down at that point. And not much longer after that, in the early 1980s, you have a cold winter where the owners of the building don't keep the heat on. And so there were a number of pipes that drain the snow and rain from the roof of the building through the building into the sewers below the building. It doesn't have gutters on the outside like a house would. And some of those pipes burst during this cold weather. And that's where a lot of that damage you're talking about happened.
And
You
still
probably
dripping and stuff. I
saw
mean, yeah, it's just,
that. Well, today it's not dripping anymore. So
Okay.
they have fixed those pipes. So that's not going to happen anytime soon. But there are still some holes in the wall, and there's places where all that water, destroyed carpeting and plaster and things like that. I don't think that damage is so severe that it, keeps you from reopening the building, but it is damage that you need to address.
So as you said, organ is gone, the gorgeous paintings are gone, all those kind of stuff, all been sold off. Okay, here we are. In trying to get the building restored, renovated, and back up to speed, what do you have a sense, having been there yourself so much, what percentage of the building would you say one day when it's reopened, people could walk in and say, this was what it was in 1925? Is there any percentage?
I would have trouble putting a percentage. I mean, the nice thing is that the architectural structure of all this is still pretty sound, and you can still feel that sense of grandeur just from looking at the shape of the rooms and the columns. They may not have all the paintings and tapestries that were there originally, but there's still a sense of grandeur just from what rap and rap the architects were able to design with this place. And there are some corners where, you can see, okay, this spot was damaged by the water in the early 80s. So that part looks kind of decrepit over there in that corner and needs to be fixed up. But the vast majority of what you're seeing as you look around the building is still very impressive.
So the group, the Friends of the Uptown, which exists, I guess anybody can join it, right? You can be a part of that.
You can volunteer.
So can you share a little bit? Is there focus now? Focus is get the place open, but talk to me about the phases of it, because is it a matter of there's exterior issues we've got to deal with, or no, that's pretty good at this point. Interior, we're okay in construction, whatever. In other words, when did they focus in on the seats and, and bringing things back to where we're getting
Well,
ready to
there
try to
was a
reopen?
period, I guess this is probably about 20 years ago now, when there was some concern about some of the exterior parts of the building, like would the terracotta ornaments fall off and things like that. So the city intervened using money from the TIF district to do some emergency repair work. So, there are some parts of the exterior of the building that they took off and they've put those in safekeeping. And they also, on the inside, they took out most of the chandeliers. And I just happened to see them recently. We did a book event at the Sanfilippo Foundation in Barrington Hills, which is this, it's like a museum out in the countryside out there.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah.
And they have there a lot of the fixtures from the Uptown Theater. The chandeliers are hanging there as you walk in, with the idea that when this building reopens, that they will be moved back into the uptown, but they are out there for safekeeping. And they've actually even made copies of them, so they've got the originals and then they've got a copy. So yeah, I mean, so those things have been done to try to protect parts of the building. But as we've moved in, since Jerry Michelson bought the building in 2008, he has been working to try to, get the financing lined up for reopening the building. I think there's probably some debate. He has architects and engineers who have plans and they've looked at it. I question whether, like he has said it's going to cost $190 million now, is the number he has used recently to get this place back into order. I haven't seen a breakdown of that, but I do wonder, there are parts of the building where do you need to make every little surface of the ceiling and the columns look glittering and perfect and shiny like it did in 1925? Or is it okay that it's a little scuffed up when you walk in as a theater goer or a concert goer? How much do you need to make it look gleaming and perfect? And how much
That's it.
do you need to just like bring it up to code so that it's safe for people to be in there, and you add modern conveniences like elevators and modern bathrooms,
Yeah, and I guess my mind goes back to the Auditorium Theater once again, where they had for a period of time brought in a guy named August Baumgarten, Baumgartner, who restored the artwork above the proscenium. And my answer to that question is, yeah, you could probably get it to a point where we can have a show again and do some things in there again. But to me, I think the Uptown deserves to be restored to the way it was. Now, that doesn't mean you can't open it at some point, and then from time to time, you need to then, it's time to restore something, close it down for a little while, whatever it is, right?
Well, and to use another example, I often go to the Music Box Theater, and
Ah,
the
there you
Music Box,
go.
nice old theater. It's not a big movie palace like the Uptown was, but they have done renovations in phases, so that they closed down for like a week about a year ago because the proscenium over the theater or over the screen, which I've been looking at for years, and you could see like, okay, there's some parts that are kind of crumbly, need to be repainted. But the only way they could really fix that stuff was if they put scaffolding up and close the theater for a week, So they finally did that. But they are kind of doing it in phases where they say, like, okay, we've got some other things we want to fix up to make this theater look really, really nice, but we're not going to do those till next year.
And
You could
the good
probably do a
news is,
similar thing at the Uptown.
Yeah, the good news, you mentioned the Garrick Theater earlier. That was torn down. I actually have a piece of the Garrick Theater here. But yeah, I'll tell you about that later. But anyway, so yeah, the thing is, because the Uptown is landmark, so the building's not going anywhere. But as you said, it seems to be unclear as to whether city council or somebody would step in and allow some other use of it, which would take away from the grandeur that it owns. And I hope that does not happen.
Well, but I do think that they could make and they should make some creative uses of the spaces in the building. So when you look at those lobbies, they're just wonderful spaces where you could hold a wedding, you could have art exhibits, you could have black box theater kind of spaces in there. I just think there's a lot of ways you could use the building beyond having a concert in the auditorium. I'm not a business person, so I keep saying this. I don't know how you make that work. And also, I mean, the owner Jerry Michelson, he has some very sincere hopes to use the building to help young people who are trying to break into the entertainment industry. So I don't know if you would have a nonprofit aspect to it, or use it as an art center of some sort. Get different community groups involved with it. It just seems like you could use the building in a lot of ways that wouldn't demean it, and it's grandeur, but could make it a useful part of the community.
Without question. And that, by the way, that's why, city council, the aldermen of the area take special concern, because get the Uptown Theater up and running and you're bringing people back up to your area. Oh, not that they're not there, but they're going, more people are coming up to that area to then shop and to eat and to do all the things you want to do before or after you see a movie or a play or a show or something at the Uptown Theater. But as I said, it's the only thing that I can think of that even parallels something like the Auditorium Theater downtown in terms of size and number of seats. And it sure deserves to have its day. I hope one day that you and I, Robert, will toast with a glass of champagne at the reopening of the Uptown Theater and just say they did it.
Yes, I hope that too.
The book is The Uptown, Chicago's Endangered Movie Palace, is available at better bookstores and online. Pick it up because it's just such a, I just, I love this city, and to have this book on my coffee table to just then be able to talk about it when people come over and take a look at it, that's really been incredible. So my congratulations to you, to Robert Lorzel, and to Andy Pierce for the work you have done. I'll say James A. Pierce because that's the way his name appears on the book as well. It's just, this is really important contribution to the architecture of the city, the growth, and also triggering some hope that people need to step in and help.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Thanks for watching us here in the bonus conversation of Behind the Curtain, and we will see you again next week. Thanks for watching.